My question is to you. You had preached on 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and the various type of people that you have in your ministry that you try to pull out and disciple. And my question, probably a lot of us here, is like, how do you keep going when you have these various type people that are out of line, won't stay in step, half-hearted towards the ministry, have committed, they'll go to football games and have all these other things around services Wednesday rather than other things be surrounded by the Word of God? How do you keep that burning compassion to be rigorous and steadfast and have the stamina to keep preaching the Word with passion?
It's a good question, Aaron. He's talking about 1 Thessalonians 5. We urge you, brethren, admonish the unruly, encourage the faint-hearted, help the weak. But the next line is the key to that passage. Be patient with all men. What you want to do in your preaching, there's a certain degree of impatience in your preaching. There's a certain degree of intolerance in biblical preaching. It is fixed. It is straightforward. It is directly reflective of what the text calls for. It is demanding. It is commanding. But in the application of that truth, you must exhibit patience. The other text that comes to mind, and I'll follow that up, is the familiar one in 2 Timothy 4, preach the word. But it says there that you must exhort with great patience. Great patience. That was very hard for me early in my ministry. You know the truth. You know the value of the truth. You know the power of the truth. You want people to process, believe, respond to, obey the truth. It's never going to be at the pace or at the level that you desire it to be. Without compromising the truth, without backing down on the truth, you must exhibit patience. You can't force feed them. You can't make legalistic demands on them. If there are other things that they do, then they don't love the truth. They don't have their priorities right. But you can't force that. Let me encourage you by saying, keep teaching, and you watch over a period of time, they will take shape. They will grow. There will be a decreasing frequency of interest in distractions. But it's a long process. And you have to continue to be faithful. And if you want those people to love you and to keep listening to you and to be endeared to you, then you have to exhibit patience with them on a personal level. I go back so many times in my mind to Jesus and the 12. Jesus seemed to be able to tolerate 12 really irritating people. Unruly, faint-hearted, and weak, right? Yeah. Oh, you of little faith association. They never seem to get it. Just prior to the cross, they're arguing about which of them is going to be the greatest in the kingdom. Blockheads. You have to realize that. And you go to the Apostle Paul, who says in 2 Timothy at the end of his life, all who are in Asia have forsaken me. Well, you don't want to come to the end of your ministry and say, everybody has forsaken me. Please, Timothy, don't you forsake me. His number one pupil, and Timothy is in danger of forsaking Paul. Paul has to say to him, stir up the gift of God that is in you. You're letting your gift fall into disuse. How disappointing would that be if he was your protege? He says, guard the standard of sound words. Is Timothy letting go of sound doctrine because the price is too high in the church and out of the church because the church was messed up with all kinds of carnality and bad leadership? Hymenaeus and Alexander had to be put out of that church. So Paul comes to the end of his life and says that when I'm at my first trial, no one is there to defend me. You know, there's a sense in which you expect nothing. And it allows you to be patient. Jesus, right down to the very end, right down to the very end, finds his most vocal disciple most disobedient. I told you, he said, to wait there till I come. Peter didn't do that. He went fishing. And the Lord had to confront him and ask if he loved him. So don't think you're the first guy who has had disappointment with the people. But it doesn't say here, browbeat the unruly, abuse the faint-hearted, and discipline the weak. It's the opposite. It's all the language of help, encouragement, exhortation. And you just keep doing that. That's the joy of coming back week after week after week after week and ministering to these same people. I hope the people in our church look at me and their other pastors as men who exhibit great patience with them. I know the outside world doesn't view me that way because they only hear me preach. They don't see the person-to-person application. And I'm sure that the sense is that Grace Community Church would be maybe a little harsh, hard, demanding, when I actually think that what characterizes our church more than anything else is loving fellowship. Because while we do not equivocate on the truth that we teach, we must remember that if we don't exhibit love, we're nothing more than a noisy gong and a banging cymbal. So, no compromise in the proclamation, but great patience in the application. And I think you have to go back to the fact that this is kind of a child-rearing process. You understand that your children, when they're small, need correction, they need loving correction, but they don't have necessarily all the wherewithal to obey as they should. It's a process of their maturation, and you've got to look at it like that. Okay? Yes, sir. Okay, well, you go ahead, sir.
Okay.
You're more refined looking.
Thank you, sir. I first of all want to say thank you for your faith in this ministry. I was at the first Shepherd's Conference and came to the first four.
Did you?
And it settled my theology. It helped me. I got saved when I was 27, had already been to college, didn't have an opportunity to go back to Bible school or seminary, but you sort of mentored me for the last 25 years. So I appreciate that. One short humorous thing is the guys wanted me to share with you that the introduction that you did to Steve's book on foundation was probably the best book you've done.
And you know what I said to myself? I've had several people tell me that was really great, and I'm asking myself, why in the world did I put it in his book? I could have had a whole book of my own.
Right. Quick question, and this is specifically from my heart concerning African American churches.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're hurting.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to research. I don't know if there's anything out there that's available from antiquity of what black preachers taught years ago. I'm reading. I have a couple of books. One called The African Preacher about some preachers in the 1800s in Virginia, where I'm from.
Mm-hmm.
And the other book I'm reading is, I can't think of the name of it, it's about Lemuel Hayes, Faithful Preachers, I think it is. But anyway, do you know of, or is there any information available? And the reason I'm asking this is because there is a wall. I love your ministry. I love Steve's ministry. But there are some African-American folk that won't listen to you because you're white.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just reality. I hate that. I can't change that.
Right.
When I learned these truths and came back in 1983, 84, I wasn't pastor. I was associate, and I was teaching Sunday school. And I tried to teach, and they told me, you can't teach that. That's white man's doctrine. So for 20 years, I've been kind of bottled up with some of this.
I understand that.
I just want us to hear the truth.
Amen.
And if you can help in any way, I appreciate it.
Yeah, I think you said it when you said you can't fix people's wrong attitudes, but you can just be faithful. It goes back to this. You take care of the depth of your ministry and let God take care of the breadth of it. I can't fix anything. All I can do is be faithful to the truth, and God has to do with it what He will. I don't know of any history, but I do know, you know Mark Dever at Capital Baptist Church? He had an associate there. Thabiti, do you know who he is? Okay, so that's the one book that I know about that would be a treatment of that. That would be the best available resource. His last name is some kind of an African name, Abba Nwili or something like that. His real name is Ray Robinson, I think. But it is. But when he went to college, he converted to being a black Muslim. And then he got converted. But by then he had changed his name. I think that's the only source I know of. And I understand this tension. There is an expectation in the black community of a certain style. And not to meet that expectation is to be accused of being bought into the white style. And it's not that at all. And there are a lot of black writers who are very, very concerned about that. I don't know if you read any of the writings of Thomas Sowell, S-O-W-E-L-L. He's a social critic, but he understands what is a legitimate complaint and what is an illegitimate complaint, and how, by virtue of this barrier saying, you know, we can't teach like or speak like white people or we've been disloyal to our people, locks those people in a certain kind of bondage from which they can't ever get out. And he's a voice, believe me, crying in the wilderness. There's some guys like him. But his is the social side of it. He's concerned about perpetuating that culture at the level it's being perpetuated at. And it is a burden to me. It is a real burden to me. I ministered for about 6 years in a row in Mississippi, way back when I was a seminary student. I was in the office of a man named Charles Evers. You know that name? His brother, Medgar Evers, was the first martyr, really, in the civil rights movement. Well, Charles Evers was a very, very interesting guy, and I was ministering with John Perkins, who had a great ministry in Mendenhall, Mississippi. And he had been saved by listening to my dad on the radio. So I got to know John. I came to the South. I brought some guys down. We did assemblies, and I preached the gospel. We had a music team, went into all the black high schools all through the South just prior to the big civil rights thing. One night I was in Charles Evers' office in Jackson, Mississippi, and some guys came flying through the door and said Martin Luther King had just been assassinated by James Earl Ray in Memphis. Before I knew it, I was scooped up and I was in a car and went to Memphis. I stood on the toilet in that bathroom and looked out the same window James Earl Ray had shot him out of. And I got caught up because I was ministering in the middle of that, going from high school to high school. They put us in jail and took all our money in that town, in Mendenhall, kind of a heat of the night type sheriff, because they thought we were stirring up social unrest. All we were doing was evangelism. So I spent a time getting to know that community and wanting to get them from a caricature of Christian preaching to the real thing. And it was a very, very hard thing to do. And yet I found some of the most welcome places, some of the most precious people, and there were churches out in the country in various places that just loved the word. It wasn't uncommon for me to preach and have them say, "Preach another sermon." I know God has His true people out there. And I think Paul says an interesting statement. He says this. Well, let me read you this statement, if I can lay my finger on it. I don't remember where it is. Yeah, it's in that 2 Corinthians 4:2. This is a statement that strikes me. It says this: we do not walk in craftiness. That's the word panorgia in Greek. From pan means all, like Pan-American, pandemic, and erg, which means to work. All work. But the word took on, that's literally what the parts mean, but the word took on the meaning of unscrupulous. In other words, somebody who would do anything to achieve an end. So it became manipulation. So he says, I do not conduct my ministry with manipulation or adulterating the word of God. Now notice this, but by manifestation of the truth, commending ourselves to every man's conscience in the sight of God. That's a stunning statement. And it says two things to me. Number one, if you just preach the truth, you have an ally in the unregenerate heart. What do I mean by that? If you just preach the truth, you have an ally in the unregenerate heart. You know what it is? It's the law of God written in that heart. And you will commend yourself to that unregenerate man because the law of God is written in his heart and he has a conscience excusing or accusing him. I see this with a guy like Larry King. He doesn't know whether to love me or hate me. I had dinner with him one night, and as he was shaking hands and saying goodbye, he looked at me in the eyes and said, I love you, John. And when we talk, he says, I wish I had your faith. There's something about the truth that rings true. You have an ally in the human heart. That's the law of God written in the heart. And you have an ally in the conscience. You have an even greater ally in the conscience of a believer. So do what you do, do it faithfully, and know that you commend yourself to the heart of a true believer. That's all we can do. How can we do more than that? The people who are caught up in style and make those kinds of accusations, I wonder whether they're Christians. If they were true Christians, it would be the truth that gripped them. You know, when I hear anybody speak, I know what I'm looking for, right? What are you looking for? You're looking for the truth. That's all. I don't care what the package is, what color it is, what kind of vocabulary it uses. So I think, sadly, when people are trained in a certain style, they can somehow sear that conscience. But I do think you have to remember that all you can do is proclaim the truth. You don't manipulate. You just proclaim the truth, and you have an ally in the human heart, even the unregenerate heart. And you certainly have an ally in the heart of one who is Christ's. It's not about style. It's about content. And you can preach the truth in any style. I just don't know where you can go beyond that. But I'll tell you, we need to be praying and pleading with the Lord to give us some African-American men who will exposit the Scripture, who know how to communicate effectively in their culture, but who make the truth the issue. It's in our church. If you came to Grace Church looks like Los Angeles. It looks just like Los Angeles, and it should, right? We're the Church of Jesus Christ in Los Angeles. It ought to look like that. It ought to look like African American, Asian, Latino, you know, whatever, because that's our city. God knows who His elect are. But the common reality is the truth. Okay?
Thank you. Well, now I've forgotten what I was going to ask. Now I want to thank you. I'm Wayne from Chattanooga. We had a couple visit us this Sunday, and they were really concerned, in a good way, I suppose. They listened to you on the radio about that topic on election.
Uh-huh.
And I told them, well, since I've listened to you for 30 years, I consider myself an expert in John MacArthur theology. I went ahead and explained that to them. So anyway, just wanted to, it forced them to get into the Bible. I said, you know what? That's great. Keep coming. And that's why they came to our church. They wanted to hear the word taught. Mm. And re-inspired them, if you will, to go seek the truth. And so I'm sure you hear that all the time.
Oh, that's greatly encouraging, brother. Thank you.
But it is, it's incredible, and it's good. And thanks for being my pastor for the past 30 years. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
I know most of these men will say the same thing, right? Amen. I just had a quick question. I took this a small Baptist church in the city. It was an independent church. And, of course, we're moving them forward, and they're responding incredibly well. I guess one of the questions that I had is more on a practical end. What do you think about identifying the church as a quote-unquote Reformed church? There's a number of churches out there that would call themselves Reformed Baptist. Of course, I just started a series on this, and what I'm going to emphasize are the five solas of the Reformation is what I mean by Reformed, those defining and distinguishing things.
Sure.
But in this city, Steve Lawson, they might know him, and in your city, and perhaps the entire country and world now, they know you. But in our city, they really don't know much about us. I've had a few people find us through the Internet because I'm linked to some Reformed sites and whatnot. But what is your thinking on actually identifying your church as a Reformed Baptist church?
Well, I certainly wouldn't have any problem with that. You just have to decide whether that's helpful, meaningful in your community. I think one of the most helpful things about our church is that it's named Grace Community Church. You know, that's better than Law Community Church, that's for sure. So you do have to make some choices, I guess, is what I'm getting at. You know, you got to ask yourself the question, the average guy out there that you're going to reach, if you call yourself Reformed, does he think that means you once had a church and it disappeared and you reformed it? Or does he even know what that means? It may not be a distraction. It may not be a problem. For anti-Calvinist Baptists, you know, that there are many of in the South, or Methodists or Church of Christ people, that's like putting up a red flag, driving a stake in the ground. I think for on the other hand, for the people that love that, love Reformed theology, it speaks volumes. I just think that's a choice that you need to make, depending on how you best want to position yourself in the community. My own feeling is that the less you say and the simpler you identify yourself, at least the more accessible you initially become. I remember there was a church in South Central Los Angeles called the Holy King Solomon Fire Baptized Pentecostal Church. And I thought, that's too many names. So I just think that's a choice that you make. It's my own personal feeling that if I had to emphasize something, it would be grace and not Reformed. Simply because that's our message to sinners. Even Bible, I think, you know, the people who the new thing is to call yourself something that's totally nondescript. You know, like the place. It's true. Or the gathering, like that. It sounds, you know, mystical. But I think Bible's a good word. I think grace is a good word. Exalting Christ. I think as long as you hit those things, you could be, you know, you could put a Reformed congregation, something like that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Yes, Craig.
In your church, when it was maybe around 300, what did you do to develop kind of the pastoral care aspect as it began to grow? I'm a preacher. I love preaching, and the kind of the small group type ministry that's, I know, very popular. Just some guidance on that.
Mm-hmm.
And then also when you were at that level or that stage, what did you do to guard your study time?
Well, first of all, you have to break your church down into small groups so people get to know each other and fellowship with each other, or you're not going to have any mutual ministry of spiritual gifts. The Lord has gifted the church, right, with spiritual gifts. And the New Testament is jammed full of one another's. Pray for one another, edify one another, exhort one another, love one another, on and on and on and on. It's got to be more than people sitting looking at the back of each other's heads. So they got to turn around and face each other. As the church gets to be 300, you're not going to find that they can all do that with each other. So you've got to figure out ways to break them down, whether they're fellowship groups. We chose to go the route of fellowship groups on a Sunday morning that they could be a part of, which would break them down into some groups. And then out of those fellowship groups, they develop Bible studies in communities so that the groups get smaller. But always the dominant curriculum in all that is the teaching of the Bible. When we talk about small groups, we're not talking about people pooling their ignorance. We're not talking about sharing their intuition or saying, what does this verse mean to you? Who cares what it means to you? What did it mean to God? So, but the idea is you've got to break people down. They have to own each other's lives. They have to sense that they have to build friendships and relationships. And interestingly enough, discipleship to me is a deep, lasting friendship with a spiritual core. And I learned many years ago that I couldn't get my people to do that if I didn't do that. So I started by picking out all the guys in my church, or a lot of guys in my church, that I thought I wanted to invest my life in, and just start investing my life in them and encourage them to invest their lives in others. That's how we build our elder board. That's how it all begins to go. But Jesus could only handle three guys and an occasional fourth. Peter, James, John, and once in a while Andrew hung around. He couldn't even handle 12. And if you study the apostles, they're descending in their intimacy with Jesus. Mm-hmm. So you get to the last group of four, and they don't really have any, at least on any page of the Gospels, any real connection with Jesus in a personal sense. So you do have to limit who you can really invest in. And as Paul says to Timothy, the things that you've heard from me among many witnesses, the same commit to faithful men who should be able to teach others also. So find the faithful and the able, not the unfaithful and the unable. Invest in that small group, and by the way that you invest in their lives, you'll teach them how to invest in the lives of others. Spiritual core kind of friendships. At this point in my ministry, here we are with, you know, lots and lots of people at the church. My life basically is built around a handful of men. Still. And then they have a handful under them, and then they have under them. And we early years we gave our elders segment of the congregation to oversee, and the deacons would come alongside the elders in personal oversight. Mm-hmm. That was a structural way. But we also caught them in fellowship groups, and we caught them in home Bible studies, small group Bible studies, any way and every way you can to catch them in relationships, so that they build those relationships together, minister their spiritual gifts mutually, do the one another's. That's how you build lasting friendships, and lasting friendships make for loyalty in a church. The second part of the question is, how did you get your time to prepare? And the answer to that is, that's a battle from beginning to end. It's different now because I have all kinds of other things coming at me. When I was very young, I had four kids. And a wife who expected occasional help. So there's always going to be something. And then, you know, as they got a little older, it was endless baseball games and football games. And I'm just like you, exactly like you. And now it's the same thing. Every organization pulling at me, every kind of thing coming at me from all over everywhere. So the bottom line is, you have this little deal I call planned neglect. I plan and neglect everything until I'm finished with what I know I need to do when I need to do it for Sunday. So I tend to be, I don't want any Saturday sermons because I don't want to make up my mind about interpretation because the clock is pushing me. So I try to start early in the week. When my kids were young, I'd wait till they go to bed and I'd do some of the grunt work, the hard work in the text or whatever. But and I tried to be home 3-4. I was out Sunday night, but so were they at church. Wednesday night, but so were they at church. One other night I'd be gone, and that would be it. And that's one of the ways we built leadership in the church, by me not being at everything. Mm-hmm. The only way you'll ever develop leadership is to give them the freedom to fail. If you insulate them against failure, they'll never develop leadership because they don't know the pain of failure. And you're not going to learn how to succeed until you felt the pain of failure. So I don't really care if they paint the walls striped. I don't need to go to that meeting. So, you know, and one of the good things, you know, about being a pastor is you don't have a 9-to-5 job. Mm-hmm. And you can invest in your kids. I used to tell my sons, I'll come to your baseball games if you come to my sermons. Basic. And I was there because if it was 3:00 in the afternoon, I was there. And at 10:00 at night, I was making up for it. But, I just think if you love your wife and you love your children, your heart's drawn there anyway. You'll figure out how to get your priorities in place and get what you've done or what you need to do done. I suggest it to guys, if you start early in your ministry to make a maximum effort to really do the best you can in preparation and preaching, to really be as excellent as you can be, you'll set a standard of expectation that you'll then have to live up to. So you want to call them to the highest and the best when they're young. And then your people are going to expect that. And that's good pressure to have because it's too easy for us to kind of slide back. Amen. Okay?
Thank you very much.
Jeff.
Dr. MacArthur, just a very practical question for you. Coming from a guy who's graduating seminary in a year, and I'm sure other guys here who are finishing soon, what is your counsel when you leave from here, wanting to preach and shepherd and come alongside people and be faithful in ministry? What is your counsel to a young guy who's graduating? You know, where do we go? What do we do?
Well, I would say two things, Jeff. One is you need to have been mentored in a church model that you think is biblical and you can own. If that didn't happen in seminary, go somewhere where it can happen. You need to have a model in mind, I think. You know, that was traditionally, if you go back over the history of the church, when guys came out of seminary, they were assistants in churches. I mean, that would be pretty typical of all denominations because they needed the experience. They needed to be covered, needed to be protected, not just from their own failures, but from people. One of the hardest things we deal with is guys graduate from seminary, they're equipped to preach the word, they go out and take a church, and the church just chews them up and spits them out in about a year. And it's half the church's fault and half their fault. So there's something to be said about having some covering, having some protection, having some maturity, some influence in your life. And if you have had that during your seminary days, then maybe you're ready to go because you've learned some things. There are just all kinds of minefields in the pastoral ministry. Being able to sort those out. You know, I don't see guys booted out of churches for bad sermons. I mean, if you preach enough of them, you'll go. But it always comes down to an inability to sort their way through the minefield of leadership issues. And I just think you need some experience there. And then I think once you've had that where you see the model and you know how it should go, and you got a little bit of an understanding of what to expect, the sooner you get into a place where you're doing the preaching, the better. I don't think, if you're really called to preach, I don't think you want to prolong that. Get at it. Because that's where you really hone your gift. It's in the desperation of standing up there and having to do it week after week after week after week. Plus, that's what contributes to your own spiritual growth and everything. So I would say get an environment where you've been mentored. If you've had that situation, then get to a pulpit. It doesn't matter whether it's big or whatever it is. Just get somewhere where you can begin to preach and test the water and bounce off the people and learn to be a pastor. Sooner the better.
Thank you.
Okay. Nice to have you here, Randy.
Yes, my name is Raphael McNeil. I wanted to ask you, what books are you reading right now, and who are some of your favorite authors?
Steve Lawson is one of my favorite authors. That book on the expository preaching of Calvin is really, really very, very good, because we're finding out that Steve Lawson didn't invent expository preaching. If you want to really read some rich things, read. I'm just going to tell you what I've been doing. This summer, I decided to read out of the box. I read a book on a world lit only by fire. Have you seen that book? By William Manchester. William Manchester is a great historian. Wrote the American Caesar and wrote the great biography of Churchill. He's written a book called A World Lit Only by Fire of the Middle Ages. Great, great book to understand Roman Catholicism. Tremendous book. A World Lit Only by Fire, the Middle Ages, an amazing period of time when life never changed at all in 300 years. Can you imagine that? How fast does it change now? 300 years. When a squirrel could go up a tree in Moscow and not have to come down till Paris. Because forests blanketed northern Europe. And village life was all there was. You never left your village. And how the Catholic Church exercised its power through the Reformation. Really helpful historically to see that. I read a couple of books this summer that I wanted to read. The first one I read was, interestingly enough, called Masters of the Air. This is out of my box completely. Masters of the Air is a story of the 8th Wing of the Air Force that bombed Germany in World War II. Incredible sacrifice of 17, 18, 19-year-old kids. 75% casualty rate. Tens of thousands of guys dying in the skies trying to bomb Germany. Flying for the first time in human history for a 2-year period, all it lasted at 30,000 feet and above with very, very primitive kind of oxygen programs, freezing, and no escorts because they couldn't develop a fighter plane that could fly all the way from England to Germany and protect them. And so when they got over there, they just got hammered by the Germans, and they're dying all over the place. Somebody needs to start waving that story in front of the faces of people who don't understand the sacrifices that people make when they go to war. These are kids. Amazing sacrifices. That's out of the sheer love of a country. They were signing up so fast they couldn't stop them from signing up, and they wanted to get in the air and go. And then I wanted to read a little about the Pacific Theater, which was going on at the same time, so I read Flags of Our Fathers. Did you read that, Flag of Our Fathers? Iwo Jima, did you see that thing? 26,000 guys die in 30 days trying to take an atoll in the Pacific, which was a fuel stop for the Japanese. Great sacrifice. And you know, then I see these Christians who can't make a minimum sacrifice for the kingdom. These are guys dying for an earthly cause and lining up. And the world lit only by fire. Those are out of the box for me. The biography of William Tyndale, written by David Daniel. I read it, I go back. A wonderful biography of William Carey by Pierce Carey, who was a relative. That is just heart-wrenching. Everything William Carey did in translation burns up in a fire. Years and years and years and years and years of work. Great stories of sacrifice. Commentaries I read all the time. Great, great new book on the doctrine of justification. Pierced for our transgressions? Wounded for our transgressions? Done over in the UK. Ivy Press. You can trust Ivy Press in England. You can't trust Ivy Press over here. Pierced for our transgressions, I think it's called. Is that what it's called? Does anybody know? Pierced, yeah. Just the best treatment that I've seen, most thorough, well done, of the doctrine of justification, which is under assault by the new perspective on Paul and by sheer ignorance, default. I'm reading things all the time. A new little book by Stephen Nichols, So Great Salvation, is that it? Something like that. I can't remember titles. It's got a bad cover, but... No, the one on salvation... Anyway, I can't even begin to say, I have about 5 stacks of books by all the places I sit, and I just kind of work my way through. Look, I put out so much stuff. This isn't coming out of the air. I got to read. It's got to come in to go back out. So, anyway. Yes, sir.
Clark Lowry from Wiggins, Mississippi, and thank you for your ministry to me personally last year.
enjoy the Shepherd's Conference. I have to confess to you, I didn't register in time this year, and it was booked up, so we didn't.
The Shepherd's Conference is full?
Yeah. It booked out about 6 or 8 weeks ahead of time, so we had no idea, and then we turned and tried to get into the League and Air Conference, and it was booked out as well.
So, listen, give me your name and address. You're in.
We decided.
Just give me your name and address. You're in. Okay.
So we just stayed home and listened to the radio. So.
But not. But next year's booked up.
Not next year, but I'm talking about this year.
Oh,
okay. This past one was booked up.
Oh, you scared me.
So.
If this next year is booked up, then somebody's falsifying the bookings to make sure that when the conference happens, nobody shows. This is a. Go ahead.
I have to echo the voices of the others, and I was sharing with somebody today at lunch, and that years ago, when I was struggling with my doctrine and theology, and maybe of the lack thereof, and trying to decide what exactly is the Bible trying to say to me, I've often described you as a lighthouse in the distance. And a lot of times it was just knowing that you were faithful to the Word. I felt if He can do it, I can do it. Especially if He's in California and can do it, I can do it in Mississippi. So the Lord proves His sovereignty again. We've been struggling.
You.
In 2001, we established a church of like mind in Wiggins. And we struggled, as Jerry Marcellino puts it. We have too much churchianity, and we're weird because we're not like everybody else. And it's been really tough, and it took us a while to grow. We started with 21 people, and we just kept growing, kept moving, and preaching the Word and ministering. And in the past 6 months, we've kind of had a break, and we actually. 2 or 3 weeks ago, broke our record and had 70 people there for preaching. So I know that's not a huge thing. A lot of Sunday school classes are bigger than our church. But at least in our area, we feel like the Lord is blessed in that.
Amen.
But with the growth, it's created new questions and new problems. We have 3 elders there. And in the process of ministering the Lord's Supper, we see people coming. Half the people that are attending are not members. And people come, and we have our communion on Sunday morning.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have people coming, and sometimes we see people that are participating that it bothers us a little bit, and we question that. We have one man who's coming who's been placed under discipline by another church, and we've talked to him about that, and he doesn't participate. And so we've wrestled with this thing about closed communion, open communion. And I talked to Tom Pennington on the phone about it, and Rick Anderson up in Oxnard, and they both sort of had an open but give a stern warning and plenty of teaching. And I was just curious if you'd like to comment on that issue.
Well, let me say 2 things. First of all, you have had a small group of people for a very long time, which has intensified all those relationships. You cannot continue to have that mentality as the church grows. Your level of scrutiny over a small church over a long haul, it's fine for that particular situation. But as that church begins to grow, you cannot expect. I mean, what did they do on the day of Pentecost? And 3,000 people believed, and they all had the Lord's table. They didn't go to 3,000 people and do a spiritual inventory. I mean, the second thing I want to say is that's all personal. Let a man examine himself. And so let him eat and drink. When you start to police that, you have usurped that person's individual relationship to the Lord. If the assumption is that every man does that, because if a man eats unworthily, he eats judgment, discipline to himself. I think the burden is on that individual. And all our responsibility is to do in the leading of the Lord's table is to put the warning there. And then it becomes personal. If you don't do it that way, what's the line? What is the line? If you had an evil thought on your way to church and you didn't confess it, are you out? Where are you going to draw the line? What, you were disciplined by another church? That might be a clear line. you know, you had an argument with your wife and you spoke unkindly and you haven't asked her forgiveness. You aren't supposed to come and worship the Lord until you go home and take care of that. Are we going to try to police all that? When you get carried away from in that area, your church will become stiflingly legalistic. And you'll just squeeze the joy right out of people. And again, this is where you exercise patience. But all our Christian living, while it expresses itself corporately, is personal with the Lord. So I would just encourage you to don't unduly try to bear the burden for that. The Lord does that. The Lord disciplines His people. He disciplines those who are unworthy and who partake unworthily at His own discretion in His own way. The fact of the matter is, if the Lord brought about a legalistic discipline on every believer who partook unworthily, we'd all have had that discipline. Right? I mean, which of us goes to the Lord's table with perfection in our hearts? None of us. So I just don't think you can take that. You can't usurp that. That belongs to God and the work of the Spirit. Okay, I think we just have time for one more question.
Okay, Dr. MacArthur, thank you for your ministry. My name is Blaine Hall from the Nashville, Tennessee area. I'm a former missionary, and so I know quite a lot about the
There's no
world.
Such thing.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
All former missionaries are dead.
Well taken. You're right.
Because there's no mission work in heaven, right?
That's right. Yes.
Is that right?
That's right. Okay.
Can I get an amen?
In the discipline of missiology, it's across the board. It's way out there, from theologically speaking, from one end to the other. I know the Master's Academy International has focused primarily on training national leaders to win their own countries for Christ. And my question to you is, in your opinion, in this day and age of where we are in church history and in missiology, and the gospel seems to be just running with power in the third world, do you feel there's still a place for Western missionaries being sent to foreign nations to plant churches?
Absolutely, yes. Absolutely, yes. We've got to go help whoever needs help. Those of us who have the truth have to take the truth to the places where Christ is not named. Let me just say this. This is kind of a generic thing to say. Missions is not a department of the church. It is the work of the church. It is not a department of the church. I don't like when I say, well, we have a missions department. We are a mission agency. We're taking the gospel to the end of the earth. The only reason we're trying to build up believers is so they can do the work of evangelism, right? So, I say this, let's just take what we know about the gospel of Christ to every place on the planet where we can possibly take it. And obviously, if you look, Jesus said He'd build one institution, the church. That's all He said. I'll build my church. That's it. It's the only institution Jesus ever said He'd build or promised to bless. So the key to the evangelization of the world is strong churches. The key to strong churches is strong Christians. The key to strong Christians is strong Bible teaching. That depends on strong pastors. Nothing is more important than going across the world at the invitation of these nations around the world and training their pastors. Strong pastors make strong believers, make strong churches, make strong missions. That to me is critical. You've got to put this in the hands of local churches. So I think anything we can do anywhere in the world to do that, to strengthen that, we ought to do it. I'm absolutely excited about it. We have 20 training centers around the world, and they've all come up because these nations have come to us and said, "Would you train us?" Steve was talking about Italy. Just give you just a fast rundown. I'm going to Italy. Steve's going to join me next week. We're going to talk to about 400 Italian believers, leaders, pastors. And this will be my, I don't know, fourth or fifth time over the last 10 years. It started, they asked me to come. First they heard tapes and things, and then they asked me to come. I came and did a conference. The church was weak. They didn't want to introduce any doctrine into their discussions that they disagreed on because their unity was so fragile. They thought that would fragment their weakness into even greater weakness. But anyway, we said that's not the way to work. You can't produce a healthy church if you're not willing to talk about doctrine. So we went over and did a doctrinal series and just dumped the doctrines of grace on them right out of nowhere. And we didn't know what the response would be. And the response was that the truth was commended to their hearts. They fully embraced it. It was like water to thirsty people. It had a life-giving impact. And so they said, could you come back? Could you come back? That's the typical pattern. And I'm going to go over there now. And they've translated books and now the study Bible into Italian. And now we've got about four cohorts of 15 guys going through our training center in Sicily where we're training in theology and expositional preaching. And that's the future. Because they are the future, like people like priests, right? People don't rise higher than their leadership. So you've got to get to leadership. You've got to be able to train leadership. That's the key. And that's what we're trying to do at the invitation of these churches and the invitation of these believers. So this one in Italy is kind of a model of that. So I hope it continues to grow. It's growing at a rather explosive rate. The challenge for us is to keep up with it, to be able to support these guys and then to be able to fund the institutions and the facilities and the we have one in Polokwane. Have you been to Polokwane in South Africa? There are all these black tribal guys out there in the tribes that are the product of missionaries of the past who come to Christ, and they have these little congregations and they wanted training. So we set up a seminary, Christ Seminary in Polokwane, right on the edge of the wilderness in the north part of South Africa. And these guys, this is how it works. It's a 36-month deal. They come 1 week every month. They make 36 trips out of their tribe. They already are pastors. They come, we train them for a week, they go back for three. We train them for a week, they go back for three. 36 months, they get the equivalent of a full seminary training. I can't tell you how many hundreds of guys we've trained over there. There's 100 there now. And that is the whole, that makes the huge difference. Because now the church is strong and doctrinal and biblical. And you're not doing some kind of once over lightly kind of evangelism, you know, with a short-term team or something like that. So that to me is the key. And I think it's critical for those who have the ability to do that to go to the places where they're asking for us to help them. Okay? Great to talk with you. Thank you so much. My joy. Thank you, Steve.